This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
This is your current affairs program, The Rainbow Report, on Joy 94.9.
Good evening, I'm Doug Pollard with another magazine of news and current affairs. It's been a dramatic week in gay and lesbian publishing here in Melbourne with the, some would say, long overdue collapse of B News and the sudden emergence of two new gay media, Canvas, an arts and entertainment magazine from Evolution Publishing, and Southern Star, a B News replacement backed by the Gay and Lesbian Australian Media Alliance, but principally the Sydney Star Observer. And while we're talking about Sydney, we've got amazing news from New South Wales. The state government has agreed to fund Mardi Gras in a deal said to be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. So joining us in the studio to talk about both these events, we have the editor of the Sydney Star Observer, Scott Abrams. Que Sera would doubtless have had much to say on this issue, but alas, she's missing in action this week. She's off doing the Joy CD launch, while her alter ego, Darren Pope, is hunched over the keyboard frantically tapping out articles for the new Canvas magazine. The seemingly interminable case against the Red Cross ban on gay men donating blood resumed public hearings this week. So we'll talk to the gay man who is bringing the action against the Red Cross, Michael Caine. And last week, the Matrix Guild, the support group for older lesbians and vintage men, the group I'm still just about too young to join, produced a disturbing report on the problems facing Rainbow seniors. The aged care system, it seems, doesn't easily accommodate out gays and lesbians. Jane Kent from the Matrix Guild will explain. Insightful comment, wit and perspicacious questions are supplied by this week's studio guest, Kathy Anderson, something of a gay media star herself, and veteran gay advocate Ron Thiel, fresh from his travels through offshore islands and Melbourne's hospital emergency rooms. Now, many of you will be aware that one of the gay papers in Melbourne had been ailing for some time. B News lost its entire editorial team, two of whom, strangely enough, are on tonight's show, editor Kathy Anderson and myself, the then news editor, in the space of a couple of months, as well as some of the advertising staff. Well, an application to wind up B News Pty Limited, brought by some of the major creditors, was heard in the Victorian Supreme Court. However, that doesn't mean there's going to be a gap in the marketplace. Evolution Publishing have announced a new fortnightly arts and entertainment magazine, Canvas, and it was confirmed that Sydney Star Observer is also riding to the rescue, announcing the launch next week of a weekly, Southern Star, with the remaining B News writers and sales team. And the man behind this venture, Sydney Star editor Scott Abrams, is with us in the studio. Good evening, Scott.
Hello, Doug.
Tell us about Southern Star.
Well, next Thursday will be the first issue on the street, so we're working frantically at the moment to try and pull that together to ensure that it is everything that the Melbourne community needs and wants in a gay and lesbian publication.
So what sort of paper is it going to be? Is it going to be a newspaper? Is it going to be a magazine? Is it going to focus on any particular, Canvas is going to be arts and entertainment and nothing else. Are you going to be similar? Or?
No, we won't be doing that. Look, one of the things that we think Melbourne deserves a proper gay and lesbian news publication, but at the same time, with some lifestyle and magazine sensibilities that obviously the Melbourne people enjoy. We want to make sure that Melbourne's gay and lesbian community continues getting an accurate and solid source of news on its street every week.
You're keeping the two writers, Andy and Nick, who were working on B News in the final days, but you're also going to be presumably using some of the expertise you have on the Star Observer, because, I mean, you've got a very good political reporter, for example.
We do indeed. Harley Dennett is a fantastic political reporter, and we're very lucky to have his services in Sydney. That said, though, we won't be enforcing the Star's footprint on the community of Melbourne. We don't think that that would be fair. Sydney and Melbourne are very different markets and very different communities. But at the same time...
But national news is national news.
National news is national news.
What happens in Canberra affects all of us.
That's exactly right. And we're very lucky in that we're able to use Harley has a great ear in Parliament. And
as you said, he's got entry to the press gallery now.
He does indeed, yeah, which is we think is a fairly significant move, particularly for a gay and lesbian publication
indeed.
In this country.
Kathy, you were working on B News for a long, long time and editing there. Does this sound like good news to you?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. I think there has been a lot of speculation about B News and what was happening with it. It was sort of erratic in its turnout. It would be on the streets one minute and not the next. And, look, there are various reasons behind all that. But I think generally...
One day we'll write the book.
I think, yeah, generally having two papers, I think Melbourne can certainly sustain having two weekly papers. We certainly, I think, proved that when we launched it as a weekly title. So it is a pity. I mean, a lot of people recognise B News for what it was. It's been around since 1992, so it is a terrible tragedy that it has folded. But if you think about it, and I'm sure Ron would probably weigh in on this debate, the history of gay media in Australia is one that's continually cyclical and particularly turbulent. So it's hardly surprising, really, that here we are in the middle of another maelstrom.
Everybody say satellite media?
It's a rising, there's another phoenix rising from the ashes, so I think it's quite an exciting venture and I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, but look, I mean, sort of given it was back in the 1980s, I think we sat down and actually tried to work out the size of the gay community, and we estimated there were probably about 60,000 people in it in Melbourne. And I'm just wondering, I mean, given two newspapers, there's all those little small format throwaway glossies, there's the other, different sort of entertainment magazines that make deep inreaches into the gay community. We've got radio, we've got television, we've got all sorts of things. And I think, maybe this proves that we can't sustain two papers.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think what they want to see and what they're not getting, particularly from MCV, because I'm assuming Southern Star will want to differentiate itself, as B News did, and having a very strong news focus as opposed to an arts focus, which I think MCV has kind of gone that way. A lot of people in Melbourne will know, obviously, of Sydney Star Observer and know of its you play a very large role in the community in terms of your association with organisations, your involvement with campaigns, particularly cleaning up Oxford Street, and you have a very strong news focus, we mentioned before, with Harley. Is that something you want to continue or want to establish, rather, with Southern Star?
We certainly want to draw some elements from that for Melbourne. We think that that's missing from the Melbourne street media
Yeah, because neither of the papers really got much into campaigning, did they?
Yeah, and look, the Sydney Star Observer has been around for 30 years next year, so obviously we know what we're doing. Mm. It's been very successful, and it's in fact one of the longest running gay and lesbian publications in the world. So, that said, again, we want to make sure that this publication has a complete Melbourne flavour, which is why we're picking up all Melbourne staff, because we wouldn't presume to know.
Mm-hmm.
But we will be trying to encourage them to follow those kinds of campaigns and community relationships that we've certainly very successfully formed in Sydney.
Mm.
Now, that part of the longevity, I think, of Star Observer may be down to your ownership structure, because you don't belong to a company or a proprietor
in the same way that everybody else does. Yeah, well, no.
Can you just explain to people how the ownership structure works?
Yeah, of course. The Sydney Star Observer is owned by shareholders, so the gay and lesbian community itself buys shares in the publication. And then, obviously, they elect a board to run the publication every year. So it's owned by the community and it's operated by the community.
And it was actually, most of those shares are actually held, I believe, by people who are by various organisations, aren't they? The campaigning organisations.
Those include it.
People
but there's
like
lots
Acorn
of individuals,
and,
yeah.
And that. They have a stake
correct.
In the paper.
Yeah, and we encourage that because that obviously means that we have a stronger tie to the community and we're hearing what the community wants and needs and we're able to reflect that in the pages of the publication.
Mm. It's something we've never had here, is it, Kathy?
Well, how will that work in terms of you owning Southern Star? Will people in Melbourne and Melbourne organisations be able to essentially buy into the paper?
Yes, they will. And we also actually have a collection of Melbourne shareholders already, people who once lived in Sydney have moved to your beautiful city, or people who were involved in the foundation of the publication way back when. So what we'll be looking to do is bring some Melbourne identities into the board of the overall publishing company so that we ensure we've got a ready ear down here all the time.
And in fact, this was an ownership structure, if my memory serves me correctly, that was set up around about the time of the Mardi Gras.
The Mardi Gras
the first Mardi Gras? Was it set up round about that time?
The Stars' history is quite a long one. In actual fact, it was owned by a Melbourne man at one point in time. So the structure was set up in around 1982.
82.
Yeah, so a little bit later than the first Mardi Gras.
But it was round about the time, from memory, when sort of gay community news was evolving into outrage down in Melbourne, which was very much a private model, whereas Sydney chose that sort of community-based right. model. And it's turned out, I think, to be an excellent decision.
Well, it certainly gives us a nice broad input, which is great.
And it seems to have given you a measure of stability, which has been missing dare I say it, pretty well all other media.
Yeah, look, I think that certainly plays a great deal in the way that we're able to continue operating and coming out on the street week after week. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's leave Star Observer and Southern Star for the moment, because I know you're really, really busy with that, and there's lots of things you still have to organise. You've been whizzing around seeing all the gay and lesbian luminaries of Melbourne for the last couple of days. And
it's been great being back in Melbourne.
Hopefully catching some sleep here and there. Meanwhile, while you've been down here, there's been this great news that New South Wales state government has finally decided they're going to put some money into Mardi Gras.
Yeah, it hasn't taken long, has it? I mean, how many
millions
of
dollars? Possibly the irony, I ask myself.
Look, I mean, we've been waiting for this news to break for quite some time now, and when word finally was official, I was talking to my staff back in Sydney in the office, and they went, yes, it's happening. And it was almost like we were cracking champagne. It was great news. And look, it's about time, quite frankly. Mardi Gras injects an average of $30 million a year into the New South Wales economy. You can't ignore that. Now more than ever, when we're finding our community increasingly recognised for its strength, the government should be showing its support.
I was interested to read, I was just looking at the Daily Telegraph online before we came on air, and their take on it is rather different. It says the New South Wales taxpayers will be forced to support the Mardi Gras parade. That's all they're really talking Ooh. About, yes? And Piers Ackerman is wonderful. He said, Piers Ackerman is really wonderful. He says that why should people who struggle to pay their mortgages have to subsidise a lot of homosexuals cavorting on floats?
Lovely. Piers has such a way with words, doesn't he? Wow.
Yeah, so this, though, as I understand it, is actually quite interesting, because it's one of the first beneficiaries from New South Wales' decision to set up a major events unit within the government, which Victoria's had for quite some time.
That's right.
But New South Wales hasn't had. Mm. And it's interesting for two aspects. The first is because this is one of the first major events, whereas what did we get? We got the Grand Prix. I think. and our community festivals aren't actually supported by the major events unit down here. And so the impetus for reform, for change here, is actually very much back with New South Wales, and this is something now that we have to pick up to get onto our major events people to start supporting our major community festivals like Midsummer.
Yeah. Well, speaking with my chill-out hat on for a moment, I mean, we've been supported and are continuing to be supported by Tourism Victoria, for example, and other government bodies in recognition of that, but you're quite right, we're not sort of wrapped up in the major events thing yet.
No,
you know?
I thought there were some overtures to the Events Corporation for, maybe it was for the Out Games, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, I don't think any of them have been successful, unfortunately.
The City of Melbourne is certainly supportive.
And of course Stonington, Yarra.
Yeah, the local councils, but not the big guns.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we need to get an F1 car in Midsummer. Maybe that's the way to go about
some
it.
Tennis players.
Yeah, or finally convince Guy to turn it into a Mardi Gras.
Are you volunteering to drive it, Kathy?
Sure would. Awesome.
Well, I understand we're going to have some Olympians in at Midsummer this year. What's it called? The campaign, what is it? Challenging Homophobia in Sport Initiative.
Right.
Are planning on organising an event as part of Midsummer, kind of round table thing, you know, people up on a platform where they're going to have
a diving platform, perhaps?
Probably. You never know.
Actually, I'd
rather have him down at ground level. Scott, we have a couple of messages here. One's a nice message here. I don't know who it's from because they haven't put their name on it. I have a copy of the first issue of The Star, which excited me greatly, as do the current ones.
I'm very pleased to hear that.
Isn't that nice? And there's one here from someone out in country, Victoria. It's great to have focus on the LGBT community in Melbourne with your new publication, Southern Star, but what are your plans for country and regional Victoria? Many people are fleeing the city but still want to have a connection to the wider community and see reporting on local matters in our own smaller communities. guess that's a case of walking before you run, huh?
Somewhat, but it's not something that's off our radar. Look, I mean, obviously we're very much in the embryonic stages of this publication, but I've been having some very significant meetings with key Melbourne gay and lesbian stakeholders while I've been in town for the last few days. And one of the things that we are doing is actively seeking ways of engaging Victoria's regional gay and lesbian community. And we're actually on the hunt for some regular contributors from some of your major out of town. So anybody who's willing to put their hand up, by all means, email me through the Star website.
Doesn't Sydney Star do that already? Don't you
yes,
give
we
over
do.
Space to regional groups to
we
have
certainly
a say?
Do. We go. We have a North Coast column, South mm-hmm. Coast column. We go to the Illawarra, the Hunter.
Yep.
And of course we have a specialist Western Sydney column as well to ensure that we're connecting with the broad community.
Okay, so there's your answer. If you've got any facility at writing and you want to keep people informed of what's going on in your little part of the world, get in touch with Scott. You can do it via the Sydney Star Observer website, and that's really easy to find. You just Google. You're listening to Doug Pollard with the Rainbow Report on Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au.
Informing, entertaining and provoking, this is the Rainbow Report.
Yes, you're listening to the Rainbow Report. Doug Pollard here with me in the studio. Ron Thiel, Kathy Anderson and the editor of Sydney Star Observer, Scott Abrams. We're going to return now to a story we've been following that seems to have been running forever. Tasmanian gay man Michael Caine only wanted to donate blood, but he was shocked and offended when the Red Cross, who were continually telling us there's a shortage of blood and pleading for us to donate, told him his donation wasn't wanted because he was a gay man who'd had sex with another man within the last 12 months. He couldn't see why, if he was in a monogamous relationship and had been practicing safe sex, that his blood was somehow unusable. Didn't they screen for HIV and other diseases? And what about promiscuous heterosexuals? Are they still allowed to donate? If so, this was clearly discrimination, and Michael wasn't having a bar of it and brought this case on. There have been no public hearings for a little while, but now they're back again, and Michael joins us on the line to bring us up to date. Good evening, Michael.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you holding up in the midst of all this?
Yeah, not too bad at all, actually. I was just thinking it's my birthday again in a few days. I started this when I was 21, so it's been going for a little bit now.
So what happened this week? Bring us up to date.
This week we actually saw, in the midst of the last couple of weeks, we had the normal hearings with our witness cross-examinations, mm-hmm. and out of that we identified the need to cross-examine one more witness, which was Professor John Caldor. And he works at the National Centre in HIV Epidemiology and Clinical Research. And it was his cross-examination that we did just last week. Mm. And that was quite an interesting thing to listen to.
So was he backing you or not?
Well, it was a bit of a mixed response, really. Professor Caldor has provided advice to the Red Cross previously on certain aspects that they need epidemiological advice. There are a few things that he agreed with us, which were obviously would have been a dent for the Red Cross case, but there are some things we're still concerned about in what he believes. Some of the things that were a benefit to the gay community were he believes that the period of 12 months for a deferral period is quite conservative, mm-hmm. Given the fact that the HIV disease can be detected in about 9 days. But obviously that's a wavelength type setup. Some people, the average is about 9 days and it can go either side depending on a specific person's immune system. Mm-hmm. But still somehow endorsed the 12-month period that they have now, even though it's overly conservative.
That doesn't make a huge amount of sense, but anyway. what was this business about? He said gay anal sex with a condom is riskier than straight sex without one.
Yes.
How on earth do you figure that one?
That's the point I said we were confused about.
It sounds like he's the one who's confused.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, how can they sit there and quite honestly say that protected anal sex with a gay couple is obviously decreases the risk, but it's still higher risk than an unprotected heterosexual couple? I think the risk involved there isn't necessarily the fact that disease transmission will happen more often mm-hmm. in a gay couple using a condom, but the burden of disease with HIV is amongst the gay community, and so the prevalence of risk is higher there. I think that's more of a statistical thing than a physical possibility.
I must admit the distinction is really rather lost on me because...
Yeah, again.
I mean, it sounds like he's grasping at straws to me.
It seems like... it sort of seems like he's trying to be the most impartial partial witness.
There's also the fact that his... I was looking at Rodney Croom's website, and he says the statistics that he's basing his case on are all taken from a very unrepresentative study.
That's right, yes.
More than half of the sexual acts reported took place in saunas and another 36% at cruising areas or beats. Well, you know, not everybody goes to saunas and beats.
Well, that's right. I mean, you can't really base the entire homosexual community's future on blood donation based on... a group of people cited in research that were primarily drawn from bathhouses and bars.
Yeah.
And, you know, for people who have had sex on premises, experiences, it's just kind of unrepresentative of what we're trying to push out from the greater homosexual community.
How has this affected you personally, Michael? I mean, you'd never done anything like this before, had you?
No.
You just sort of... you got your dander up, as it were, and decided to go on with this. How has it changed you, being involved in all this time?
I think it's given me a lot more of a perspective on what things people should stand up for. I know myself, previously, I've taken on the approach of, oh, what's the point, you know? And I think a lot of people probably think that when they feel something's wrong or they feel that they've been hard done by something they think is wrong, mm-hmm. and they just go, well, what's the point? They're big. I can't take them on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I'd done that myself previously on certain things, and I thought this time, and because I think it was because of the fact that donating blood is such an altruistic act, being turned away from it, it's a safeguard that you don't even perceive to put up. Against hurting your own, getting your feelings hurt and things like that. You honestly, to do something that's trying to help someone so much and be told, nah, sorry, it really gives you this negative feeling, and I think it was that which what fueled me the most mm-hmm. to seek out help.
Cathy Anderson, you want to come in on this one?
Yeah, hi, Michael. We spoke a couple of weeks ago about this when the first round of hearings went through, and you mentioned that you weren't sort of doing this for, you know, on behalf of the entire gay community, that you did recognise that there were people who perhaps might not be eligible to give blood or that that it was more of a personal crusade. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I understand that this case is primarily based around the homosexual community, or MSM, or gay and bisexual men, as that's me, and that's why I'm taking this case. But there are other aspects which have the same sort of principle, really. When you look at people who have had a tattoo or a piercing, if it's been done by a professional with a license, through a licensed professional, yeah, there's no reason that they shouldn't be allowed to donate blood either.
Mm.
Yeah.
Ron.
Yes, Michael. Look, I mean, this is a show that makes, absolutely, and indeed a radio station that makes absolutely no claims to impartiality or neutrality. So let me congratulate you on being a fantastic role model, you know, to the entire gay community, actually getting up and, you know, doing something which you believe in. I think it's fantastic. I started to wonder, though, that this thing's been going on for so long. When do you think it will end? And what do you think the outcome will be?
Yes, I've often thought this myself. When do I think it'll end? I honestly didn't think it would take this long. I was incredibly naive when I started this. I thought it'd be, you know, a few spruced up letters from a lawyer and it'd all be over, but how incredibly naive I was. What's happening now, we've had this cross-examination from Professor Caldor. This now opens up the witnesses that have already given their evidence now have an option to readdress his evidence. So that could happen within the next 3 to 4 weeks.
Mm.
Then after that, we'll propose a couple of days for closing submissions, which is more of a legal summary of where both sides stand. After that, the court will go into deliberations to come up with a verdict, which I've been told to estimate will take around about 12 to 18 months.
12 to 18 months?
Absolutely.
That's for the verdict. And then we've got to get action on the verdict.
So they're obviously going to go over this very, 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 very carefully.
But Michael, isn't it? This is a good sign, isn't it? Because this new witness that you've been hearing, the tribunal actually asked to hear from him, didn't it? Is that right?
That's right. Yes.
So they wanted more information. They wanted to just to clarify things. So that's good. That does sound positive.
That's right. Yeah, and I mean, I was told that the evidence that Professor Caldor was to give had the potential, really, being based around epidemiology, which seems to be one of the key professions to understanding the real crux of this case, had the potential to really make or break the case. Mm. And I was extremely nervous, but I thought to myself, if he provides evidence against my favour, against what I'm trying to do here, and the tribunal agrees with that, then I can only look at the fact that I've stood up for what I believed in, and I was doing what I thought was right, and it didn't work this time. And that's not because it's wrong for it to happen, it's just we don't have the right studies and information to prove that it's right just yet. And that's what helped me get through that.
Okay, Scott, you wanted to come in here.
Yeah, I did, Michael.
Scott Abrams from the Sydney Star Observer.
Michael, I was just curious as to know, these kinds of very public cases tend to have quite an impact personally, and I was wondering how you were standing up to that and what kind of difference it's making to your everyday life.
It gets a little hard, I think, in my working life where I'm away at certain points, or sometimes I don't focus probably because I'm thinking about different things that are happening. But on a social level, whether it be from strangers or friends and family, I've had a predominantly very good experience. Like, a lot of people have been extremely supportive. If people don't understand, they've often sought information. Sometimes it comes across a little bit harsh, but they just probably have a defensive stance on the Red Cross's side to start with, as a lot of people probably did, but that's where education is probably the key part of getting the public to support this kind of case.
Well, you've become a little bit of a media star in your own right, and I must say you're doing really well at it.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you very much for that, Michael, and we'll be following the case with interest.
Great, thanks a lot.
That was Michael Caine from in Tasmania. Now, we've had some feedback on there. There's a question here I can't actually answer from Tristan. I would like to ask, if a transgender can give blood, like from M to F or F to M, I have absolutely no idea. Are they classified as gay or what?
Gosh. I don't know. It's a sexual practice.
Yeah, I couldn't be definitive, Doug, but I would imagine that's a question of gender as opposed to a question
of
sexuality.
Yeah. Yes, and therefore I would assume, yes, you can.
I would have
thought
so. I think
there'd be steam coming out the Red Cross's ears if they tried to get their heads around that, wouldn't it?
I don't think
there's anything in the Red Cross manual about it.
Okay,
we have
another SMS here. This one's for Scott. MCV is very left-wing and arts-focused, I find. Hopefully, Southern Star will be more news-focused and more representative of the gay community. That's from Jonathan.
So more young Jonathan. Liberals in there. Please.
We certainly try to be. We'll try and be a voice for all people.
I'll try and get him to put a young fogies column in for you, Jonathan. How about that?
Yes, I mean, that's a problem with the right wing, really, isn't it? You know, they don't really have anything interesting to say, and when they do say something, it's incoherent.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station.
Okay, a report was published last week entitled My People. It told stories of the difficulties elderly gays and lesbians face when they need aged care services, either in their own homes or in residential homes, and it told, in essence, of people being forced back into the closet. Jane Kent, community development worker at the Matrix Guild, was the project coordinator for the report, and she joins us on the line now. Good evening, Jane.
Hi, Doug. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Tell us a little bit about this report. What did you find was the principal problem about getting aged care for rainbow seniors?
Well, what we found was there's a lot of hidden abuse of different kinds or other out there in different facilities and with people that are recipients of aged care services. As you can imagine, it's quite wide. Some of it's more serious than others, but that's what we found from interviews from 19 different GLBTI seniors.
Mm. Now, we should stress here that this is not, generally speaking, motivated by malice so much as by ignorance.
Absolutely, yes. And I think that there's generally a fairly good will to find out more about GLBTI seniors and their culture and their needs, and also how, obviously, their needs are neglected sometimes. It's just simply that it's a bit of an unknown area for quite a lot of the service provider's staff. So we're sort of coming at it from a positive point of view, and we've been distributing the report and getting very good feedback. There's another report that's just about to come out, and that actually works directly, that's interviews with people who are directly working in the industry. So that's very specific as to what's been happening from these people's point of view and what they suggest as to how resources and situations can be improved. Following after that, we're looking to find monies to employ a lobbyist to use this information from the data from these two reports to lobby government to change policy and procedures, standards, regulations.
Okay, so you've got a whole plan laid out here. Scott Abrams, you wanted to come in on this.
Yeah, Jane, I'm just curious. Obviously, Australia is a rapidly aging community, and we hear that it's a message that's constantly being pushed upon us. I'm assuming that you would have some kind of time frame for addressing this issue, given that we've got those pressures.
Well, all of this is happening fairly quickly, actually. I mean, we received the monies from the Reichstein Foundation, and we're working in collaboration with Vintage Men last year and this year, and the third stage is planned for next year and possibly going into 2010. So the quicker we get it out there, the better.
What can the broader community do to help you with this?
They can certainly have a look at the report that we've just published. It's on the Matrix Guild website. That's www.matrixguildvictoria.org.au. So they can definitely have a look at the report. And if you're involved in any organisations that would be interested in using the research to further our ends, that would be wonderful. And also just to talk about it, let people know about it, and also to try and change attitudes, particularly if you're involved in any way in the industry. I think that one of there's two areas that broadly cover the main reasons for this. It's invisibility and cultural neglect, really. It's the cultural situation for GLBTI seniors is something that people often aren't aware of.
But just to interrupt you there a second, sorry. Jane, I mean, isn't it true to say that it's not just GLBTI seniors? People don't expect seniors to be sexual.
Exactly. It's older people are seen as asexual, and so we're even more marginalised than they are, because we're normally marginalised in the Australian society anyway. So with the older situation, we're even further marginalised.
Yeah, I've got a question here from one of our listeners who says, surely by the time most of the listeners require aged care, the ethical and moral attitudes of the current general aged community itself will have changed. And does the report take into account the age or generational grouping of the people studied?
The last bits of it's strange.
Yes, I know. I think what he's trying to say is that at the moment, when you have gay and lesbian seniors in perhaps a retirement facility, the majority of the heterosexual majority will basically be fairly ignorant about gays and lesbians. But
yes,
by the time some of us get into the aged care homes, that our co-residents, whatever their sexuality, will have been exposed to much more information.
It's an interesting point, and it's certainly true in lots of regards, but behind the comment is a kind of a problem with age. We actually get that with Matrix Guild, because we find that sometimes younger lesbians say, well, why should we support senior lesbians, because by the time we become senior lesbians, all of this will be sorted out, so why should we bother with your issues now?
I think that's probably what he was getting at, yeah.
Yes, and you know, I do understand that, you know, that where that's coming from, but nevertheless, the quicker that we can make these changes, the better it'll be for younger GLBTI people when they get older. I mean, a lot of these things can be swept under the mat. and a lot of the abuse is very hidden, as well as the seniors that are very invisible in the facilities at the moment. So we've got a long way to go. And the quicker that all of us, whatever ages we are in the GLBTI community, get together on this and support groups like Vintage Men and Matrix Guild, the better and the quicker, the more thorough will be the changes by the time the younger people in our community do age.
Well, Ron Thiel, you're sort of...
yes, I mean, James...
More on the senior end of things, perhaps.
Yeah, right, Doug. Just as well, this
is
television.
Glass houses, Doug.
No, sorry, Jane, just to take you off on our slightly contrary mood there.
Yeah.
No, this question of, you know, deep physical intimacy as distinct from, you know, expressions of you know, sex... I mean, it really is a concern that runs, you know, right through the entire, certainly sort of gay male community where you know, it's actually very difficult to establish intimacy with people because we just don't live in a, you know, in a society which encourages it. And it would sort of be nice to sort of not only recognise that older people can probably teach younger people about intimacy, but, you know, people can discover intimacy between each other independent of their age. It's got really nothing to do with physical intimacy.
And dare I say as well that there are a lot of people in our communities that a couple can be have quite a bit of age difference between them. And also I think that there is more understanding between generations now than there has been, so there is an improvement.
Okay, Jane, look, we're going to have to leave it more or less there because we're running a little bit short on time. Thanks very much for that, Jane, and the best of luck with it.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
That was Jane Kent there from the Matrix Guild.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au.
Keeping the GLBTI community up to date, this is the Rainbow Report.
Yeah, and this is Doug Pollard with me in the studio. Ron Thiel, Kathy Anderson and Scott Abrams from Sydney Star Observer. Before we go on to our next guest, I thought we'd catch up a little bit on the SMSs. Someone SMSed in here, but you made that rather provocative remark earlier on.
I never make provocative remarks.
I used to like Ron till that last remark.
Oh, they've misinterpreted me.
I can't even remember what the remark was about. Yeah?
But
anyway, there's one for you, Scott. When will this new paper, that's the Southern Star, Bobby. Bobby wants to know when it'll be out on the streets.
Oh, Bobby, it'll be out on October 9th, next Thursday, a week tomorrow.
Next Thursday.
A week today.
Come on,
Oh, gosh. No wonder you're exhausted.
Yeah. Okay. Scott's in the middle of a coronary.
I'm about to have one, I think.
Okay, now it's time to catch up with matters political with Australian Coalition for Equality spokesperson Corey Earlham. And even though very little is actually happening right now, it would appear there is movement behind the scenery. Coalition seemed to shift their position on gay law reform a little bit last week with remarks from the Shadow Attorney General, George Brandis. Corey, good evening.
Good evening, guys. How are you? Welcome aboard, Scott.
Thank you very much. Hi, Corey.
Now, what did George Brandis say that was so different from what the Coalition have been saying before?
Look, the reporter from the Sydney Star Observer was able to get out of George Brandis that this reform would go through regardless of whether their amendments got up, and this is a very positive statement being made by a member of the leadership team in the Liberal Party. It throws a lot of weight behind what they're saying. It's no guarantee. There's no absolute. There's no party room resolution, but it's a good step in the right direction.
Do you think there is actually now gradually a change of atmosphere coming through the Liberal Party since Malcolm Turnbull took over?
I think that there was a definite appetite for change prior to Malcolm coming on board, and now that Malcolm's leader, that appetite's able to come to the surface.
Okay, Ron.
Yes, because, of course, Malcolm's you know, political life very much depends on him keeping the homosexuals on side, doesn't it?
Well, there's some people that say that Malcolm vote was won by the gay vote in Wentworth, so there's others that say that he could diss the community and he'd still get in.
I know during the whole election campaign, Corey, that Malcolm was and still is in constant communication with the Sydney Star Observer and is, in fact, a subscriber to the publication, so he knows he reads it all the time. And he certainly is very conscious of his pink voters, that's for sure.
Look, Look, I think that's twofold. One, you have a very excellent reporter in there that's very good in investigative journalism. And he bought, Harley builds a very good relationship with members of parliament. But the second side of it too is I think that Malcolm, before he went into politics, very much supported the GLBTI community. He and Lucy were on the AIDS Trust board, support BGF every year. So there's just this general ethos coming from Turnbull that, that this is the right thing to do, that the equality should be achieved. Now that he's leader, perhaps some people that were swaying their decision are falling in rank behind him.
Because you also said our position on this bill, as with all the bills in this reform, is that it should have been done years ago. So, well, I mean, that is basically a knock at John Howard and Co, isn't it?
I guess that's one view, and in the same article, Brandis said that Costello was a reporter of change behind the scenes, and I've heard that in other sources before today.
Yeah, well, Peter Costello never seems to have been able to manage to do many of the things he did behind. Well, it says he's for behind the scenes. He never got the leadership, and he never got this up either. Ron?
Yeah, Corey, look, it sounds like for the first time ever, there is an in fact, certainly since the fight against AIDS, that there's an opportunity to develop a bipartisan agenda for, you know, progressing the situation of LGBTI people. Is sort of ace, you know, sort of thinking along these lines?
Look, I think there's two levels of bipartisan. There is a palette to make change, and then there's bipartisan for the actual change. I'm not confident that there's a bipartisan support for the detail of the change, the terminology, the definitions that have been proposed by the government. There's no guarantee that there won't be amendments to those. There's no guarantee that some terminology such as the definition of child or parent for the non-biological parent won't be amended by the opposition in the Senate. There is, however, coming out of the opposition, this taste for the changes should occur. But as everyone knows in this process, and many listeners have heard us talk about this before, the devil's in the detail. So until somebody comes out and says, we will support this recommendation as it stands, we always need to remain optimistic and hopeful and thankful that they're coming forward to make positive statements, but also a little bit cautious of the fact that that detail may not be what we think it means.
Right. Now, let's leave that one aside for the moment. Victoria, parenting reforms. That's chugging along nicely, isn't it?
My understanding is that it will come up for debate next week in the lower house. A lot of members of parliament are very tired of the conscious vote debates that have been occurring with abortion and euthanasia. There's some wonderful work being done by the Rainbow Families Council and the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby and others to get this reform through, so it'll be an interesting debate to watch and listen to.
Conscience, huh? That's a tough one.
Sorry, Corey, does that mean that this will be a conscience vote, or everyone's just a bit over it, so they're just going to let it go through? I'm a little bit off, because that sounds ideal.
Well, look, I think the fact that everybody's over it may mean that it doesn't go through.
Right.
People are tired of having to push for these things, but the Labor Party has come out and said that there will be a conscience vote on this issue. The Liberal Party has not yet publicly confirmed or denied whether or not they'll have a conscience vote. That will be decided next week.
And this is the legislation based on the Victorian Law Reform Commission's report on surrogacy.
Yeah, Artificial Reproductive Technology Bill 2008.
Right.
God, you know, it just must be so tiring being a parliamentarian, you know, actually having to think things out from first principle rather than being told what to do. It'd be a nightmare, wouldn't it?
Well, not only that, Ron, but, you know, there's been quite some vicious debates around abortion, people being told that they're murderers, people being told that, you know, they're going against God's will from some quadrants of the community, both on the euthanasia debate in the upper house and on the both houses for abortion. It makes it an interesting social change environment when you've been debated and protagonised for basically going against traditional conservative view.
Yeah, let's face it, though, Corey, it's the environment we've lived with forever.
It is, and in
one
sense... It hasn't killed us, but we've also done incremental changes. So this is a massive amount of changes in a short space of time, and we just need to consider that in the way that we approach it.
Yeah, that's true. When you look at it, there's been this massive social change agenda, certainly in legislation that's been going, just even in Victoria with all this stuff. I mean, you're right, people will certainly have a lot to chew over.
Well, I think this kind of legislative indigestion is the result of the, you know, everything being so constipated during the Howard years, if I can continue the same metaphor and perhaps take it a step too far, that, you know, nothing much was allowed to get through in the Howard years, certainly not at federal level, and even the stuff at state level was very much frowned on.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, in terms of state level, like, you know, you had, you know, sort of, I said, what's his name, Brax, who was this big social character who did nothing, and then you've got this dour, dry treasurer, Brumby, who had this reputation for being a sort of fiscal-oriented conservative who's unleashed all this social reform on the states. Fantastic. I just can't trust politicians.
It's great that it's all happening, but I think what's really important now from this point onwards, though, and both nationally and from state to state, is that government spends some money educating people on what their rights are as well. It's fine to actually change it, but it's about time that they started explaining it as well.
And, Scott, I think that you'll find here in Victoria we've done that. I probably don't agree with the panel's view on Brumby versus Brax, because most of this reform's come out of Rob Hales, and he's been very progressive on these issues. But Victoria's great on education. They've created the overtherainbow.org.au website to provide information for all state-based changes.
But the other thing, Corey, too, and you may probably agree with this, is that the bill going through the Victorian Parliament and the bill currently going through federal Parliament are both based on pretty heavyweight reports from fairly heavyweight organisations, the Human Rights Commission, the Law Reform Commission in Victoria. I mean, this isn't just legislation whipped up by a couple of, you know, minority lobby groups and said, right, here you go, fellas, have a vote on this.
And that's a credit to Australia for the fact that they're actually getting involved in the human rights argument. It's 60 years of the Human Rights Charter being created nationally, and Australia wants to be a leading player in that. So it's good to see that these things are finally coming through and actually getting passed, and there's bipartisan support, at least in principle, if not in fact.
Yeah. Well, these things are happening, and as I said, they didn't happen for a very long time, and no doubt you'll be back again to tell us all about it, Corey.
Thanks a lot, guys. Talk to you soon.
That was Corey Earlham there from the Australian Coalition for Equality. And that's about it for this week. My thanks to my guests tonight, Scott Abrams from the Sydney Star Observer, Ron Thiel and Cathy Anderson in the studio, Michael Caine in Tasmania, Jane Kent of the Matrix Guild, and as you just heard, Corey Earlham from the Australian Coalition for Equality. Don't forget, you can now access podcasts of the program at joy.org.au, as well as my blog at rainbowreporter.com. Big, big thanks to my producer, Bianca Johnston, and technical producer Michael. And I'll be back next week with another edition of The Rainbow Report.
This has been a Joy 94.9 news and current affairs presentation.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.